you. Well, how would you like it brought to you? If you're passionate about your coffee, then a Passion for the Bean is for you. At a Passion for the Bean, they custom roast coffee beans from around the world when you place your order, so your coffee is guaranteed to be fresh, rich, full-bodied, and full of flavor. That's not the taste that you get from coffee beans that have been sitting on a supermarket or coffee house shelf for weeks. Now, to have the ultimate coffee experience delivered to your home or office, call a Passion for the Bean at 480-703-2326. That's 480-703-BEAN. A Passion for the Bean has joined forces with the American Stroke Association in the fight to end stroke. Now, you can help by purchasing an ASA signature blend, and 30% of the proceeds will go directly to the ASA. Help us put an end to stroke. The life you save may be your own. And call a Passion for the Bean today, 480-703-2326.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective. And we're here on KXAM, 1310 AM in Phoenix. And you know that we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? And when we deal with mental health issues, and we're talking about holistic, we're talking about balance. We're talking about balance in body, mind, and spirit. And today's topic is about balance. It's about empowerment. It's about becoming all you can be, which is basically the essence of every show that I do. The title of today's show is When I Grow Up, I Want to Be 60, which is also the title of a book by my guest tonight, whose name is Wendy Crisp. And before I actually get Wendy online, I'd like to talk a little bit about issue of getting older, whether you're a man or a woman, and the fact that it seems like I've been dealing a lot with female issues and female energy for quite a while. If you remember, I had my friend and one of my teachers, Sandra Ray, on a few weeks ago, celebrating her birthday. In about 3 weeks, I'll be attending Louise Hay's 80th birthday party down in the San Diego area. And so a lot of my teachers, as for all of us, have been women. And I seem to be surrounded by women who, as they're getting older, feel the power of who they are and continue to be role models and teachers, and maybe not continue to be, but very often engage that energy for the first time. One of the other interesting things that I've been doing lately is I've been reading a lot, but I've been reading things, a lot of novels lately. And there was a book I picked up that just looked interesting to me, which was on the bestseller list, called The Constant Princess by Philippa Gregory. And she wrote three other books. And I, by buying The Constant Princess first, I got to read all four of her novels in the order of when, not when they were written, but chronologically in history, because they're the story of what went on between Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth I. And it was really the story of two powerful women, both with their own beliefs, trying to make the world as they believed it was supposed to be. Years ago, I read a book called The Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley. To this day, one of my favorite books. But I've recently started doing the same thing. There were a number of books written by her, and the most recent one released was called The Ancestors of Avalon, which actually historically took place before all the others. So what I did after reading The Ancestors of Avalon, which basically is about the goddess, about the energy and the power of women as earth, as the womb, and the rituals and the belief system that surrounded it back in ancient days. And I read The Ancestors of Avalon and then the Forest House, it's called, and then after that, The Lady of Avalon, and now I'm back at The Mists of Avalon. And again, it's been grounding me so much more in my own aspect of the female power in the world, and very often how much wiser and how much more at peace this world would be if we actually grounded ourselves and paid more attention to it. So with all that being said, we're going to be talking about when I grew up, I want to be 60. In today's Los Angeles Times, there was an article that says experts urge lawmakers to help ease growing mental health crisis in seniors. And I just want to read one sentence here. Seniors account for a fifth of all suicides, many by firearms. Nearly 40% show signs of depression, but only about 3% seek psychological help, the experts testified. So what I'm hoping with today's show is those of you that are out there listening become more aware of whether you are living in a dark space or whether you're moving into the light more in terms of what you're doing with your life and taking a really good inventory about what it is you are doing with your life. Whether you're a man or a woman, it really doesn't matter, and that's really the essence of today's show, but the framework we're going to be talking about is women. And it's so important. Milestones happen for all of us. And for many of us, it's those zero birthdays, the 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. And some of us try to ignore it. Some of us actually do take stock of our lives and try and see whether we're on track or not on track and where our piece is. And that's what we're going to be talking about today with my guest, Wendy Crisp, who is an author, a teacher, and somebody, as she says in her introduction, a child of the 60s like myself, which to me speaks very highly of somebody who's committed to community and committed to changing the world around us. So Wendy, with all that being said, I really want to thank you for being on the show tonight and taking time out of your Friday night to be with us.
Well, thank you, Stuart. It's a pleasure.
And I want to remind my listeners that as we progress, this is a live show tonight, so if you want to call in and you're in the Phoenix area, the phone number here at KXAM 1310 AM is 480-949-1310, 480-949-1310, and it's the same if you're listening via the Internet outside the Phoenix area, 949-1310, area code 480. So, Wendy.
Yes.
What else do you want us to know about you before we start talking about the book?
Well, I think that I've been I was the niece of a newspaper editor who put me to work at when I was 9 years old. So I've been a writer and editor as a career since I was 9, and I'm 62. So you do the math, and that's what I've done with my life. I've been a magazine editor and a book editor, and I've written books and articles and newspaper columns, and I'm a public speaker, and that's the career I've had. I'm a mother I have a son, and I have two grandsons and tiny little grandsons. Our family breeds late and seldom, and and I'm happily married. I've been married for 7 years to a man I met on Yahoo Personals. So uh-huh. I think that's and I'm a very active volunteer, and I have been, when I could, most of my life. I started a business venture and it failed, so I got to be a volunteer then, and various times in my life. And my main volunteer work has been in local fundraising, and the direct people volunteer work I've done has mostly been in women's prisons. Mm-hmm. And so and I'm now on the board of a couple of corporation and a foundation in San Francisco that I'm the president of, and we are just starting to do work with incarcerated women as they are released from prison who have children under 5 years old, and doing family and parenting issues with and rebuilding families. So that's going to be an exciting new venture in volunteer work. And I work full-time as a writer and an editor out of my home because I never put anything aside, as Vera Charles, who was Auntie Mame's friend, said, I never put anything aside. So I have to work until I drop dead. But so that's basically, I guess, and I live in Northern California on my family farm. I did most of my career in L.A. and New York. Spent 15 years in both places, lived for a while in Portland, Oregon, and inherited and retired, well, didn't retire, you know, inherited and changed my life and came back to the family farm in far Northern California. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's pretty much it in a nutshell. I was completely interested to get off of me in your Los Angeles Times story about the suicide rate among elderly people, because I have seen statistics on that and been following that in several. There's a couple of excellent, I'm very much into the internet, and there's many, many excellent blogs that are done by senior citizens. I don't use that term for myself or anybody else, but for but those of us who are of a certain age, there's a lot of very, very, very smart and very competent people writing daily on the and one of them writes on aging issues, and she had covered it, the suicides among the elderly. And you know, it's I don't know if the Los Angeles Times article gave the gender difference, but it's quite a difference. It is men far more than women.
Actually, it did somewhere in the article.
And
here.
The gun is kind of the giveaway. Very few 80-year-old women shoot themselves. The reason I think anecdotally, to get on your, and you of course are the mental health expert here, but I believe that the way that we age as men and women is very different, and the way that we approach aging and the way that we are able to absorb aging, because I have a very, very good group of women friends, and we are all between the ages of 55 and 65 or about that age, and we are just having a ball, and everybody we know and all of the friends of everybody we know and everybody we know over the country and people we connect with on the internet, everybody, they're having this fabulous time, and the men are battling depression. Mm-hmm. And very few of them get together and talk about it or deal with it, but they feel useless. They feel useless professionally. They feel useless physically. They feel useless sexually. They feel unattractive. They've got hobbies, and they begin to think their hobbies are meaningless. And you know what different? What? How is this going to do anything for the world? Mm-hmm. It's an extremely interesting thing, and we're talking about educated, interesting men that we find, you know, exciting and we're proud of. And mm-hmm. But we can't tell them this. You know, you can't build someone else's self-esteem. I mean, you can support it, but you can't. You know, it has to be something they believe themselves. But you see, we talk about this a lot. The husbands just don't know how to redefine themselves when they are no longer, you know, the highly marketable person or the jock.
Well,
or whatever.
I think you hit on it right there, Wendy, because I think in our society, in fact, my bachelor's is actually in sociology, and then I went on to do the master's in counseling. I think in our society, for the most part, and even today in this so-called enlightened age, men are defined by what they do in
yes.
terms of how they're earning money and what their career and
much
the kind of
more
respect
than
they
women.
Have in the community. Yes.
You know,
I said that.
I got to interrupt you because I really want to make this point. I was the editor of a magazine for Career Woman for years, and I was the head of a group called NAFI, National Association for Female Executives, for years, and I was very into women and careers and that whole movement, and of course had a career of my own. But it never, and it didn't matter how successful or how brilliant or how far up the ladder a woman went, she was not defined by that job. You could say, oh, you know, it's just terrible. She didn't make partner at the law firm, and now they won't even let her work part-time, and she doesn't even know she's going to be able to practice law anymore, but you know she still has those beautiful children in that lovely home. It just didn't matter. But with a man, you could never say to a man, oh, well, you know, he was bypassed and didn't get the promotion, and now he's going to be laid off, and they're offering him early retirement. But, you know, he has that lovely home. He has a lovely family. You know, that doesn't cut it for a guy. You can't make the same argument. The standards are different, and they have the father tape going in their head. You know, what kind of a man are you? What kind of a man doesn't provide for his family?
Well, I think another aspect of it is, and, you know, I hate to say it, but I think it's still true, a woman could have a full-time job, but she's still expected to organize the house and take care of the family and everything else, although I do know a lot more men who participate almost equally, if not equally, in a lot of that when it's a two-career family. But the woman very often can make that shift when she's ready to retire, if she's ready to retire at any point, to continuing things that, for many of them, were still very fulfilling parts of who they are, the nurturer, the caregiver, the mom, and then grandmother.
And then also, you have new roles constantly. Women are able to redefine, we are able to reinvent and redefine ourselves at the drop of a hat, honey. I mean, I'm not this anymore, I'm not that anymore, you know, I feel really bad for like a whole day and a half. And then by then, hey, I've got a new idea, I'm out on something else. And even my, you know, we all have different personalities, and different women will experience that and express themselves in different ways, but they know what I mean. They wake up one morning and say, I was just reading an essay. I just published an essay by a woman on my website. She's 65, and she wrote an essay about, hilarious little essay about dancing naked in Alaska. It's great. But anyway, and she said this long-term friend that she had, her husband died very suddenly in the 80s, and they'd had a trip to India planned to visit the daughter who was in the Peace Corps, and the woman was going to cancel the trip, and the other woman said, no, I'll go with you. And they traveled together, realized they traveled well together, and they've been traveling on exotic, wonderful, exciting trips all over the world for the last 25 years. They have men in their lives, and the men stay home. The men aren't interested in whitewater rafting, you know, in Alaska. They're not interested in tramping around in the Himalayas, you know, and so these women have completely redefined themselves from who they were when they first met, you know, in their late 20s, and when they were young mothers and stay-at-home moms, and now they're totally different women with totally different takes in their lives.
I think there's another thing you brought up that I think is an important point, and again, I hate generalizations, and it's that sociological part of me, but I think women tend to have an easier time making new intimate friends later in life than men do. So I think the social network for men, as they get older, starts dying off. And it's usually the women that keep the men engaged in whatever activities in terms of let's go to this club or let's do this, whereas women, I think, have an easier time if there is a loss in their life of certain parts of their friendships. There seems to be an easier time for them to make friends of women their own age as well as mentoring younger women and younger men.
That is all true. And there's also one very somewhat amusing reality, and that is that because the woman is sort of the keeper of the social keys in a relationship, a male and female relationship, you know, she's the one that, you know, decides that they're going to be a dinner party and all this kind of stuff. She also decides who is and who is not welcome in the home. And some women are way more subtle about this than others. There's a variety of styles, but every woman in the world knows what I'm talking about. And often a man will come, especially if you've met a man in midlife, at any point, you know, if this is a second marriage or a third marriage or whatever. A man comes with, like I said in one book I wrote, a great book, but nobody bought it. But anyway, I said in one book I want, the perfect man has only two friends. They're both weird, and the two friends don't like each other. That's the average guy. He's got two friends, you know, like Larry and Frank, And Larry and Frank can't stand each other, so the three of them never do anything together. And he golfs with one and fishes with the other or whatever. And Larry and Frank never have girlfriends or wives that the wife can stand. You don't do things socially with him if you can possibly avoid it. And it's sort of like he goes fishing with Frank, and that's your week to, you know, like get the house clean or, you know, go to the quilting convention or something. And so all of a sudden, the guy's isolated because his friends haven't been integrated into the social fabric of the marriage social life.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people say that men don't have friends, what they really have is friends their wives won't let them see. You know, or, you know, that the wife has been an obstacle to the development of intimate friendships in many, many cases. And most women, the women, I can promise you, the women who haven't been obstacles would have liked to have been, but they were just too kind.
Okay, and now I want to say again that I know that we're generalizing because there are exceptions to all of that, and I've known many families where couples where that there is a crossover and there is that mutual support for people's socializing together with friends as well as separately. And I think a very healthy relationship allows for that separate socializing without jealousy and without
right.
Thinking something's wrong with that. So you mentioned one of your other books. You've written two books that has to do specifically with those milestone years. The first one I'm thinking of was a bestseller, 100 Things I'm Not Going to Do Now That I'm Over 50.
Correct.
And that came out in 1995.
I wrote that, yeah, right. Yes, I 112, but I know a lot. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wrote that in 1994 when I was 50. I was born in 1944. I'm in that strange mm-hmm. cohort of World War II babies. No one talks about us. We're not boomers. We're not the people before us or the people after us. And we grew up in all-women communities and in all-women homes because the men were either old or 4F or gone.
Right.
And women ran the towns, and they ran the businesses, and they ran the homes, and the homes were matriarchal in the sense that they were filled with laughter and hilarity and egalitarian procedures, mothers and grandmothers and aunts and everybody hanging out together and the radio on all the time because of the war and the whole world pulling together, and we grew up with that. And then the men came home, and we said, well, who's this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or in my case, actually, my father didn't come home. He was killed, so... Anyway, that's the age. That's my age category.
Okay.
And so I wrote the book, 100 Things I'm Not Going to Do Now That I'm Over 50, which is a very positive book. It sounds like a non-positive book because of the title, but it's a very positive book. And I had to revise it. Putnam, my publisher, wanted to bring it out again this year, which they did. And they thought that there were one or two entries I might have to revise for the generation that's turning 50 right now. But when I read the 100 things, there were 43 I had to change because there's
wow.
such a difference between the people who are turning 50 now and those of us who are 60 now that I had to revise 43 of the 100 things. Also,
one
the times
stand out?
Have changed. Well, for one thing, some of it's just the times. I never mentioned, for example, email. I made some negative comment about obscene faxes. Well, who does, you know, that's like Stone Age stuff. But one of them was, one of the things I'm not going to do now that I'm over 50, in 1994, this made sense to my group, I said, I'm not going to refer to the Second World War as the war. And I related an incident where I'd had an employee working for me, and I said to her, my father was killed in the war. And she said, mine too, where was yours? Mine was in Da Nang.
Right.
And I realized right then and there, I was never going to say the war like that again. Well, mm-hmm. that doesn't have people who just are turning 50 now. That's not their point of reference. They don't use that point of reference. So that was one of the, you know, the one of the standouts as in terms of the revising that I did. And then when I turned 60, my publisher asked me to do this book, When I Grow Up, I Want to Be 60. because the 50s book had been so successful. And I was a little stumped because it had been the publisher's idea, not mine. The first book had been my idea. And I thought I had said everything I had to say. Well, you know, I'm a woman. What is it? Of course I hadn't said anything I had to say. I'll still be speaking from beyond the grave. So I said...
Well, now that you're an author, you will be.
Well, yes, yes, but not only... I should leave tapes. Play this, you know, January 2070. And so I was a little bit stumped. And then he said, well, why don't you... there's a lot of famous people like Cher and Susan Sarandon and all these people, and Diane Keaton. Why don't you interview these people and do quotes on them about what it's like to turn 60? And then that annoyed me. I thought, well, who cares what Cher has to say about turning 60. I care about what real women with real lives, you know, not these extremely exaggerated media conscious, you know, lives of entertainers. I care what their experiences are. So I sent out about 90 emails and I convinced about 60 women to write what it meant to them to be 60 in terms of an S word. You know, 60 being an S word. I just chose that as a gimmick to make it easier for people to focus. And I got these wonderful things. The book says, over 60, all grown up, and now we are. And like one woman wrote, spring chickens, and another one wrote, subdued, and another one wrote, svelte, and another one wrote, all grown up, now we are surprised, now we are slippery, now we are swift, now we are sexy. The sexy one, I've got to tell you this, Stuart, I think this is one of the best ones in the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
Because over 60, all grown up, and now we are sexy. And just this one, I wrote the opening anecdote, and it says, a strappy sandal dangled from a long leg, showing off perfect hot pink toenails. Wow, I said, gorgeous, and your toes match your poncho. Yes, she said, and under the poncho, I have no breasts. My feet are the new, why don't you come up and see me sometime? And then the quote on the other side of the page is from my friend Maureen. She said, my last cancer checkup came back clear, and she goes on and talks about it. And she says, of course, I don't smoke, I don't drink alcohol, and I avoid fried foods, all of which I thought was saintly enough, but what does that leave for fun? See above. I love that attitude. That is what this book is all about. This book
It's also the attitude. You're talking about feeling sexy and being sexy, but that also translates in a lot of ways to people over 60 who are still sexually active, and a lot of people don't get that and don't realize it and don't respect it or think, oh, I don't want to talk about something like that. You know, but we know it's the case that the age does not determine someone's desire for intimacy sexually as well as emotionally, and because of that, you know, the number of HIV and other STD cases within the senior population is climbing at an exorbitant rate, and a lot of people don't realize that and don't address it, that women do feel sexy and do desire it. Men are men, speaking generally, in terms of, you know, sex is still important if they can still get it up, but now there's Viagra, you know?
Well, I think one of the things is that in our culture especially, everyone knows that other cultures are not like ours. Ours somehow equates sexiness with youth, which is like one of the lines in my book says, you know, youth isn't wasted on the young, but sex is. You know, youth is supposed to be the sexiest thing in the world. I look at these 20-year-old men and women that are all over the TV and the newspapers and all that, and I think, you know, I'm not even attracted to a 25-year-old man. I mean, what's sexy about a 25-year-old guy? So he's got a flat stomach. That's sexy? What's sexy is, you know, their mind and their sense of humor and the crinkles around their eyes and the sly smiles. And I mean, let's get real about what's sexy, and you don't get that until you're over 50 at least.
Mm-hmm. And well, there's the external sexiness and the internal sexiness, and you're talking about, you know, perception and how our life's experiences start reflecting outward from as
yes,
defining who we
yes.
are.
You become, you look like who you are inside by the time you get to be 50. you begin to, your character shows on your face by the time you're 50. And when mm-hmm. it's somebody who's passionate and compassionate and has a lively mind and a great sense of humor, and that shows, I don't think there's anything sexier in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
not that
we're
sexually active. Not that I'd throw the flat stomach out of bed either myself. But,
Well, I think if that was a criteria of too many women my age, we wouldn't have anybody in the bed. So I don't. Some of us aren't bothered by that kind of thing. But it's I think that it's naturally our children and mm-hmm. especially our children, even more than our grandchildren, our children don't want to have to discuss our sexuality, and frankly, I don't want to discuss theirs either. So that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were talking about the structure of the book, and actually, since it didn't come in the mail like we expected, you emailed it to me, and I read the whole thing in less than an hour, and actually pulled out pieces of it that really resonated with me. And again, like I said at the beginning of the show, the book you aimed by women for women, but the reality of it is that I really believe men ought to be reading this too. And it really said a lot to me. So the way you have it is, like you said, it's very simply put, on one side of a page it says, over 60, all grown up, and now we are, and then the S word that whatever the woman that wrote these for you, defined for you. And then I believe on the right side of each page, you wrote something. Is that correct?
I wrote on both the left and the right. When you see the book, their only quote is the one in the book that's italicized. I do the majority of the writing.
Okay, so I want to read a couple of them and let's talk about them, because the first one that jumped out at me is sisters, and you wrote, "We ignore the dated stereotypes, the ones that separate us into the women who went to Woodstock and the women who didn't, the ones who backpacked across India and the ones who day camped at Swope Park. The years worked a strange magic. The hippie is a stockbroker. The PTA president felts in a yurt in Uzbekistan. The corporate vice president stays home and babysits her grandchildren." And then on the other side, you wrote, "There is but one circle to complete, and complete it we do, no matter where in the circumference we started." Beautiful statement.
Thank you.
And then the quote that's triggered it all was written by a friend of yours named Anne, and it says, "In sisterhood there is celebration. We celebrate our lives, ourselves, and each other, sometimes with belly laughs, sometimes with teary eyes, always with true sorority." Which actually is the essence of all of these Avalon books that I've been reading. It really is powerful to read your book in the midst of reading all these books about the myths of Avalon. But this is about dated stereotypes and honoring the difference in the paths that men and women take to get to 60.
Yes. And this, when I said that, there is but one circle to complete, and complete it we must, no matter where on the circumference we started. You think of when you think of this circle, all of the different places we started. We come round to the same spot. So when I am in a place now that maybe somebody else was 20 years ago with what I'm doing with my life, and they're more where I used to be. But we all understand the evolution and the cycle of this kind of development and integration of a full person. It's an extremely exciting adventure to watch as all of the pieces of your life come into play and begin to. It's like having a jigsaw puzzle with 1,000 pieces, and all of a sudden you sit there. Remember when you were a child and you first started doing that kind of thing, and all of a sudden you sat there and you said, I can see the picture. I see where it's coming now. I can see it coming together. And that's what it's like. It's such an exciting thing. And I can't, I know that there's negative things about aging. My back hurts or my hand hurts or I got carpal tunnel or a little arthritis in the hand that I type with. But, I wouldn't trade it for any of that, for the beauty of the integration of this, all these decades coming to this fulfillment and being able like you said earlier in the show, to reinvest this in community, to reinvest this into the projects and the work that will improve the lives of others or the environment or wherever it is, or the church or the synagogue or wherever it is that different people are putting their energies and their work into their passions. Everything comes together, and all of a sudden, everything you ever were works for you in terms of doing outward things.
Well, you're talking about something now, and that brings me to the next one that jumped out at me, and it's the word satisfied. Because I know that there are people listening, men and women listening tonight, and again, if you have a comment and you want to call in and ask a question or put your two cents in, or if you're disagreeing or agreeing with something we're talking about, the number is 480-949-1310. So I'm going to read the one that you said satisfied, because again, there are people listening who are saying, my life isn't this wonderful awareness of all the things that the world has to offer and all the things I've accomplished, and I'm just struggling day to day, and I've not done the things that I really wanted to do in this life, or I'm filled with anger and rage and I can't get past it. And to me, that speaks to all of the self-empowerment issues and the things that need to be healed. And under satisfied, you wrote, I said, quote, I said, I did the best I could, and as soon as I said it, I knew it wasn't true. I'm certain my great report card in the sky has the notation, quote, does not work up to potential, unquote. But I did the best I could at doing the best I could. Does that count? And then you continue to write, all roots ennoble, all roots humble. And I love that too. All roots ennoble, and all roots humble. And in 80 years, all roots converge. One day, we lift up our eyes from the road less traveled and discover ourselves in bumper-to-bumper traffic. Satisfied. What do you say to those people that are sitting saying, I'm not doing the things that I thought I'd be doing by the time I was 50 or 60 or even 20 or 30? You know, how do I get unstuck here? What do you say to those people?
None of us are doing the things we thought we would be doing at any of those ages. I'm not even doing the things I thought I was going to be doing when I was 50. It isn't even a matter of looking back more than 10 years. I don't have the income, and I don't have the discretionary income, and I can't do the things, a lot of the things I was thought I would be able to do. My son and my two grandsons live 3,000 miles away, and I almost never see them. My husband has a son with and five grandchildren, and they also live. My children live in New York, and his live in New Jersey. I've been writing and editing all my life, and I'm never going to win a prize. I'm never going to win a Pulitzer. I'm never going to, be a household name in terms of being a writer that everybody, I could put everything against the wall that I thought I would want to do with my life, and I could find something wrong with it. But I can also look out my window. I'm in the place where I grew up as a child, a happy, happy place, my aunt and uncle's place, where I live now, a happy place for me. And I can look at what I have done instead, and what I have done, and who is in my life instead. My children and my grandchildren are not here. But what is here is a family down the road with children and grandchildren who don't have grandparents within 3,000 miles because they're farm workers from Mexico. And my house is filled with children all day long. People run up to me on the street and hug me. People are running in and out of my house all day long, borrowing something, returning something, mowing my lawn as a surprise, coming over to kill the chickens and bringing back tamales. The little kids, I'm going the first day of school to take pictures. We're making movies at the birthday parties. I'm more of a grandmother than I ever dreamed I would ever be because I only had one child. Now I have passels of grandchildren. They adore me, and I am busy all the time with these families. what a blessing, because life hasn't geographically put me in a position to be a grandchildren with my own grandchildren, a grandmother mm-hmm. with my own grandchildren. So you have to constantly look at, I can live a wonderful life right where I am, right in the conditions that have been dealt to me. I will play this hand. You know, everybody watches championship poker now. You know, a lot of people sit in front of it and watch all this championship poker. Well, the game is to play the hand you've been dealt. If you have to bluff, bluff. A lot of people have won on a pair of twos, and uh-huh. you can too. There's no, you know, there's no such thing as people through great tragedies of their own or great health issues or terrible career or job disappointments, and you can still play a winning hand. You can still say, look at your life and say, there's so many good things in it, I wouldn't trade this for anything.
Mm-hmm. And I say to those people who are still questioning is, there are things that need to be done in your own community. This is where the children of the 60s part of us come out. You know, I did a show back in 2004 called The Legacy of the Woodstock Generation, and it's on the archives, and I really encourage any of you to go listen to it, because I do believe that that legacy, you know, I was at Woodstock, and I was in college during that time, and there is a legacy that came out of the generation that you're talking about that you came from that also spilled over, because we're talking about that time in history where, you know, feminism was born, and we thought
we could change the world before we were 30. We thought that the world would be different by the time we were 30, and then we could go off and do something else with our lives. Like, well, once all the social problems are solved that we're working on, which will be, you know, like in about 10 years, then I'm going to be writing novels.
Right. But the truth is, we did change the world. And it may not, I mean, obviously the job's not done, and hopefully by our continued activism, and those of you that are out there saying, I have nothing to do with my time, your continued activism sets a tone and an example for the generation coming up behind you, and maybe two generations coming, the little children that see what you're doing in the community are learning from it. And they're learning that it's okay to speak out, even if it's unpopular to speak out about what you're speaking out about.
And they're learning that there's great, I'm teaching them on a very personal level, Stuart. I teach the people around me, teach in the classic sense. I'm not a teacher. But what I have to teach is what I was taught specifically by my aunt, and that was that there is unbelievable blessings and joy in the smallest pieces of life that you can find, that an entire day can be made bright and wonderful by the appearance of a water skeeter on the surface of the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that poetically or metaphorically. I mean that if you are the... if you look at life through the eyes of a child, and you, whether or not you have a child with you, and you see these things, you realize, yes, I am blessed. I am blessed to see this. I'm blessed to hear this piece of music. I'm blessed to have that friend in my life, that person who called, that person who waved at me, that smile. And I find, and my women friends have shared with me the same. We've talked about this a lot. I just have to tell you that a bunch of us who are all this age, 55 to 65, and I recommend this for every woman I know of that age, we have a group called the Joy Potluck Club, as opposed to the Joy Luck Club, you know, that great novel. Well, this is the Joy Potluck Club, and we meet whenever someone says, I need a Joy Potluck. And that's when we meet. No officers, no agenda, no meeting, no anything. We always take a collection of free will offering and give the money to the rescue mission or whatever else is on someone else's mind. Or sometimes we give it to people we know as a, you know, anonymously, who we know are in trouble at the time. But the point is that we get together and we share things like this, like finding in life the smallest possible joys rather than looking for the big hit, the big rush. You know, I want to sell my book. I want to get, you know, I want to, meet the man of my dreams. I want to, go on a trip around the world. I want to have a sailboat or whatever it is that people want to do with their lives. It's so much better to get up in the morning, get in the shower, and realize how fortunate you are to be standing for as long as you want under a stream of hot water.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt taught me to do that. Don't take anything for granted, because the joy there's so much. You have so much abundance. If you don't take anything for granted, your life is so abundant you can't even begin to deal with it.
Which gets me to anger. anger gets in the way of everything in our lives. Okay, and then under the word serene, you write, why are so many elderly women angry? Where do they come from, these rage junkies, high on this cheap, contagious, addictive source of adrenaline? Spare me from the pushers of hate, and spare me from my own weakness that tempts me to treat the blues with a red shot of anger. And then you continue to write, the evils in this world, regardless of the cyclone of fury generated, are not centered in she who immersed the congregation's 80-cup coffee maker in the dishwasher. The evils in this world are war, famine, pestilence, and plague. The same old four guys and the people who ride with them.
Yes, I believe that more than anything.
And to me, and I say this on the show a lot, I've done shows about it, is anger kills. And what I'm saying is we've seen anger killing other people, but the repression and the lack of healing of the anger within ourselves kills us,
yes.
Kills the individual.
We see that a lot here because I live in a community that's multi-generational, and it's a very small town. I live in a town of 1,500 people, and I was born here, so you see a lot of you can see the generations in the stories. And I see people literally who kill themselves with their own anger. It's a form of suicide, and I can't be critical of this because I don't think people want to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
People don't say where can I get a good dose of anger? I need it. But I do think that people, and women especially, maybe not especially, but I just know women better. Women especially use it as a source of adrenaline. That it actually is an antidepressant. To be angry is an antidepressant. People medicate themselves with anger because at least it keeps the adrenaline flowing.
Right. The other thing that I know it does is it protects people. It keeps, as long as the anger is raging, it keeps them separated. It keeps them alone, and it keeps them from risking opening the heart and getting close to people and dealing with the realities and the truths that haven't been dealt with and dealing with the possibility that they might let someone close again and actually feel the joy and the serenity and all the other things we've been talking about if you let go of the anger.
I think that, it also covers up tremendous feelings. I mean, obviously, we only get angry when we're angry somewhere, we're very disappointed in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We get angry because we have failed somehow a tape within ourselves. And so that makes us angry at other people because they're liable to find out. They're liable to see us for the jerks we really are.
Right.
And the sadness part about that is that everybody is feeling the same. Everybody has the same feelings of inadequacy.
Right.
Nobody, no matter how they behave, positively or negatively, within the major zone of mental health, nobody really thinks, it has it all together and has a perfect life and thinks they're great and everything's smooth, and there's no such thing. That isn't how the human beings are put together.
Right.
So to envy people or to be angry or to think that you're inadequate and no one and everyone else is adequate or have whatever these feelings are is a tragedy, and it's a real tragedy in old people because it does isolate. It isolates immediately. No one, we have someone, I can say this because I doubt that anyone in my hometown will get this show because all the people that I emailed about it, are going to stream it, are going to stream it elsewhere. But we have someone in our church who has spent the last 2 years dying very slowly of cancer, and almost no one has gone to visit her because she was so horrible. Even when people went to visit her, she was so horribly angry and nasty and mean and mean-spirited that finally people just said, I can't do that to myself. I'm sorry she's dying. I can't do it anymore. You know, send the pastor. You know, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Right.
And, you know, so here's this tragic situation brought entirely on the fact that this person, you know, couldn't open her mouth without a frog jumping out.
Mm-hmm. Well, which brings me to the next section, which is basically, the word is selective. And to me, it's very important that you're selective as to the situations you put yourself in and the people you have in your life, those that nurture and feed you. I mean, obviously when somebody's dying, sometimes you need to kind of step above that because, you know, we don't know what that's like and what that might be going through. But you have the word selective here, and I love what you wrote here. What do we cling to? What will we release? Other women in other times jettisoned grand pianos on the banks of raging rivers and marble-topped break fronts at the base of the Rockies. What do I carry in my heart that should have been abandoned on the prairies of the past? And then you write, when a dear friend, gesturing hilariously about the breakup of her last romance, knocked my great-grandfather's Staffordshire dog off the shelf and onto the flagstone, I knew it was the dog's time to go.
Yes. You just can't hang on.
When do we let go? When do we let go?
You let go when it interferes with your humanity. The minute that you that an object or a subject or a memory is blocking your ability to love and listen, then that object or memory or subject has outlived its usefulness. It's got to go. It's because anything that blocks us from listening and loving is destroying our lives. It's got to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of end-of-life issues, the last one I want to read is the word sanguine. And to me, it's an issue that I've talked about a lot, especially through all the years of the AIDS epidemic that I have experienced, that all of us on the planet have experienced. And you write here under sanguine, death is not what scares me. What scares me is someone else writing my obituary.
Yes.
Unless we write our own obituaries, our legacies will be defined by young people, young family members who, while we hope are racked with grief, nevertheless will have to hire a caterer for the wake, meet with the attorney, and ask Betty if she can sing I'll Fly Away at the services. Our life story will be a rush job, and it will report that our greatest joys were reading, gardening, and visiting our grandchildren, the obit writers. For the photograph, Ryan will choose the picture he took last week when they had you propped up in bed. Lisa won't let the others mention your first two husbands, and no one will recall that you once won the Nobel Prize in Physics.
Yes.
How do you want to be remembered? And to me, it's such an important thing. I mean, that the exercise we do a lot with clients and stuff is write your own obituary. What do you want to have that read when you're gone? Have you achieved that? What keeps you from doing it? Or are you satisfied with what you see?
I wrote my own, of course, and filed it with the local hometown paper here where I write a weekly column called From the Back Pew. And I wrote my own, and the young editor was a woman. She said, this is so crazy, and this is so hilarious. And I said, I don't want anyone else writing my obituary. And I put a little quote in it from me, and I said, I'm sorry I'm dead. I didn't want to die yet. I wanted one more glass of wine, one more laughing, wonderful time with my friends, one more hike up the hill to look over at the ocean. I went on and on and on. I just said, it was a great ride, but I still wasn't ready for it to be over.
Well,
she wouldn't have wanted it that way.
And I'm not ready for the show to be over, but the music tells me it is. How is that for perfect timing?
Great.
Wendy, I really want to thank you for doing the show tonight. I'd love to have you on again.
Oh, I'd love to do it.
And I mean that. And I want to tell my listeners, if you want to reach Wendy, you could go to her website, iwanttobe60.com.
And that's
60. 60 is 60. Or you can reach her through my website, tellthetruthfaster.com, and you can tell your friends that this show will be archived by the end of the week so you can listen to it again. And you can get her book at Amazon and most major bookstores. I want everybody to take this seriously because this is a wonderful book and very inspirational. Thank you, Wendy,
so
and thank you all for
Stuart.
Listening.
Bye-bye.
So this is Stuart Altschul on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next Friday. Have a great weekend.